best in poker strategy. DeucesCrack.com presents Deuce Plays with Bart Hansen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Deuce Plays. I am your host, Bart Hansen, and today's episode for July 5th, 2011 is the World Series of Poker 2011 with Tommy Angelo. As always, you can email the show at deuceplays@deucescrack.com. That's deuceplays@deucescrack.com. Check out the forums over at the homepage and follow my Twitter. So we're going to get to Tommy Angelo here in a second, and I think this is like the third time that he's come on the show. I grabbed him up a couple of days ago, and we did this interview from the Starbucks, the Rio. Nice to, you know, interview people face-to-face, get a little bit of a different feel than when I do it over Skype. And so it went pretty well. I cashed in an event from last week. It's the Omaha High-Low, half Stud 8. I basically barely min-cashed and played pretty well and just got real unlucky on a hand where I made a flushy low and lost to a better flush and low. And, you know, that was it. But I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty much done playing at the World Series this year. I'm going to be working for Poker Productions and ESPN. And actually on, I believe it's Thursday the 7th, or it actually could be, Wednesday the 6th. I'm not sure. We're doing a webcast of the final table of the 50K, and I believe I'm going to be doing some color commentary on that. So you can check that out again on ESPN3 on either Wednesday or Thursday. I'll be doing some color commentary on the final table, which will be No Limit. It's funny, it's an 8-game, but the entire final table is No Limit. Other than that, I've had a pretty good series in cash. I've played a lot of 150, 300 OE and some 75 Omaha, and I've been pretty happy with the results. Now, before we get to Tommy, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some news about the new website and my future with Deuces Cracked. I know that I made an announcement last week talking about how I was going to go off to do my own podcast on a website, and it was going to be a subscription. And I think that was a pretty good idea. Little did I know, however, and it was kind of bad timing as I couldn't really, you know, spend a lot of time with it as I was at the World Series. Little did I know how difficult it is to actually take a product and sell it online. And what I mean by that is actually have a credit card processor. Like, you would think, you know, I have a product, I'm going to set up a recurring subscription, there's some sort of software that can do that, some sort of processor that will easily allow me to do that. Well, there isn't. For an individual, apparently, and I actually would, for people that know about this stuff, please email me, because I'd like to know more and more. But from what I've seen, and when I've talked to the Descract guys, a lot of sites that have recurring payments, like, for example, porn sites, poker training sites, they have basically hired their own web developers to write programs to process payments. Now, I could use exclusively PayPal, but even in the limited, you know, response that I've gotten after making the announcement a couple weeks ago, I know a lot of Europeans don't use PayPal. I know a lot of people have problems with PayPal. So I think that it would cut like 40 or 50% of the possible, you know, listenership if I were to just use PayPal. So for as of right now, I don't really know what is going to happen, but it looks like I will still be working with Deuces Cracked in somewhat the same capacity that I have been before. What we're thinking about, and this is extremely preliminary, is making Deuce Plays a subscription kind of add-on for members of Deuces Cracked. We are thinking of making it subscription for people that aren't members. I don't know the details, but it would be something like, you know, for people who are members, they would pay less than the full subscription rate. And then maybe for people that pay, you know, their full subscription up front for the year, it might be free. something like that. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. This is just stuff that we're kind of throwing around. But it appears as though the future of Deuce Plays is that it will be a subscription-based, but it will still be hosted on Deuces Cracked. So that's how things stand right now. So again, definitely feedback. Now, some people would be like, well, you know, they're changing it from making it free to subscription. Well, what if Deuce Plays moved over to my website and it was just subscription? You know, in this case here, people who are Deuces Cracked subscribers will get it at some sort of reduced rate. So, whereas Deuces Cracked subscribers, if they went to an independent podcast, like I was thinking about doing, would pay the full rate. So for Deuces Cracked subscribers, it's a better deal. You know, for everybody else, yeah, the podcast is going to turn to subscription. Timelines and stuff, again, everything's really, really up in the air right now. I'm going to wait until the World Series of Poker dies down. But I, you know, I'm sure Deuce Plays will be free through probably at least the end of, definitely the end of July, if not the end of August. And then, you know, we'll keep you updated on how this stuff gets squared away. So with that, we're going to get to our interview. So here we go with Tommy Angelo. Hey, everybody. So we are back here from the World Series, and I want to welcome a special guest onto the show, Tommy Angelo. How's it going today, Tommy?
Great.
Now, we are at the World Series of Poker at the Rio. Now, you don't get a chance to play a whole lot of live poker these days, right?
Yeah, I haven't been playing that much locally where I live in California. I used to play it like a Chances and Bay 101 daily. And since I've been doing more coaching and writing, I've just been really enjoying that even more and haven't really been playing that much except when I come down here.
So you've been to the Rio before for this whole experience?
Yeah.
You have? Okay. Because, you know, one of the things I want to talk to you about, and obviously we've done maybe 4 one-hour episodes with you in two different parts, and you know, we talk about the mental aspect of poker and emotional control. Mm-hmm. Get a lot of emails from people before the World Series, even though we're taping this during the World Series, that ask, what should my approach be, you know, to the World Series? I'm traveling from out of town. I've never been to Vegas.
Yeah.
You know, should I just play tournaments? Should I play cash games? Should I rent a place? Should I stay in a hotel?
Right.
What's your old take on everything?
Well, I do go over all those questions with some of my clients, and it is specific to their situation. You know, it is really the main thing I feel my role is to just, like, caution them, you know, against the potential demons that exist here, and have them really think in advance, you know, try to get over their excitement about coming and think in advance and plan for how they're going to right their ship physically and mentally when things go sour for a few days. And that, I think, you know, is the most important thing, is be ready to take some time off, you know, be ready to really get away from the game and kind of shake out the anxieties when things get too stressed. And then and the other thing I go over with them, how the best make it less likely that will happen, is to really try to at least eat one really good meal a day, you know, really healthy, good meal, and drink water, and, you know, get sleep. I mean, it's hard. It's really, really hard, especially on the tournament grind and the frustration of busting out. You know, it's very difficult. So those are the challenges everyone faces on the road, especially when you're, you know, you're young and you got money, you're coming to Vegas, it's all exciting. It's really easy for the wheels to fall off at some point during the trip. And that's sort of what I've help them sort of look forward to.
So you think that it's definitely something to be said for it to have, like, maybe one night a week of some sort of scheduled, maybe going out to a...
Oh, sure.
To a gentleman's club, perhaps?
Well, just something that's not poker.
Yeah, you know?
I mean, there's got to be some other option. You can always go golfing when it's 115 degrees out. That's some guys do that.
There's also a store where you can shoot guns, too, right?
Ah,
the gun store.
Uh-huh.
And there's a pinball arcade. I mean, a pinball museum.
Yeah.
And I've been to both of those. So yeah, there's definitely some good daytime activities to do here, too. But, you know, when people are listening to this, there's going to be some young kids coming in just for the main event. Because we're recording this actually a week that in our time, this episode's coming out a week from today. So that's when people are just going to start coming in, you know, for the main event. And the main event is a very, very long grind, the way that they have it structured.
Right.
To the point where you probably aren't going to cash until at least day four, which is a week in. And you're playing 8 hours a day with some days off. How do you prepare
for that? There's lots of days off, right?
I mean,
if they have four first days and two second,
How does one go about preparing for that?
That's the again, it depends on each person, but just to have some plan for activities that are going to, be non-poker, that are just going to keep you sane. For example, if I were playing in the, let's say, day 1B, okay, and so I know I'm going to have 1C and 1D with something else to do, I really can't think of anything particular, say do this, do that. But the idea is just to have a plan, So, if you got, a couple of days off during the series, there are some pretty good things to do around Vegas, which is go to Red Rock Canyon, go walk around Hoover Dam, which is awesome. Take the full tour where you go down to the bottom. If you got any buddies in town, just go run around, do something with them that's not poker. I think watching movies is an excellent distraction, just to sort of keep your mind away from the poker and keep it clean. But at the same time, of course you're going to be thinking about poker, you want to be planning to be really focused physically and mentally on that day. So like the day before, make extra sure that you don't go out drinking that night. Make extra sure you do eat a light meal that day. Those are the things that I think are really the things that are most in our control that have the biggest difference on how well are we going to be performing at midnight. That's what I'm looking for. A lot of these guys play great. Who's going to be standing strongest mentally at the end of the day? And that's going to be whoever did the best physical and mental preparation going in.
Now, we've had other health coaches on in the past. Do you believe that an actual physical workout regimen is a key to being successful as well, especially like at an early age, at a young age?
Yeah, I do. I think that physical and mental health are completely intertwined. They just can't be separated. And so anything we do for our physical health is going to make us mentally stronger. And anything we do for our mental health can actually help take care of some physical, problems.
Now, one of the other things too, when people come here and they don't know how to approach the World Series, and I don't know if any of your clients ask you this, is there something to be said, you think, to, if you're going to play a lot of tournaments, to not play cash games, or vice versa, to stick to one discipline because they tend to, I guess, mix each other up? I mean, I have a lot of friends that go by that
they
try. Mantra.
They think it should be one or the other. Kind of thing.
If they're going to play a lot of tournaments, they stay away from cash games. Yeah. And if they're going to play a lot of cash games, they'll only play like the main event.
Right. I have some clients like that. The real danger zone is somebody who plays tournaments and then goes to play cash games while they're in the state of like having just busted out. That's the biggest risk. And that's usually what I'm looking around for, is disasters. But for some players, in fact, I just talked to a guy yesterday, he uses the cash game to wind down. It's lower stakes than he might necessarily be used to putting on the line, and it's actually part of his, end of the day therapy. So it can go both ways. But generally speaking, the biggest danger is playing cash games after you bust out of a tournament. But other than that, I don't think there's any, one size fits all thing on that.
One of the other things I just dealt with, because when we're recording this, I just busted from the the OE event, and my numbers might be off, but it seems to me like I throw out these numbers just because they're convenient for the point that I'm going to make. It's almost like cash games are 90% skill and 10% luck, and tournaments are 90% luck, 10% skill. So as a cash game player, I have difficulty dealing with that because I'm not used to, I guess, the type of variance that comes with playing a lot of tournaments. Usually, if you're a good player, you win.
Yeah.
I found that not to be the case in tournaments.
Right.
So does one deal with that?
I don't deal with it very well at all. That's why I don't play tournaments. It's a sick kind of pain that tournaments deliver. I have a great deal of respect for the people that basically grind tournaments that know they're only going to cash less, well less than half the time or whatever, and just go in there and do that anyway. I mean, there's really no easy way out of that except, the awareness. Just know that, you're going to, if you're exactly average, you're going to cash 1 out of 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
That right there tells you, okay, there's going to be a lot of losing going on. The thing I find frustrating about tournaments is that I like the immediate gratification or the immediate punishment. from my consequences of my decision. So if I make a really good bluff, my net worth went up at that instant. And if I make a bad payoff, my net worth went down at that instant, where all of the consequences of tournament decisions are postponed. And the frustrating thing is you can make 10 great decisions, but then the final decision that makes the most important for you, that's most important, is a no-brainer. As often comes down to just an automatic play when you're short stacked or whatever.
Right, right.
So these are some of the frustrations I had with playing tournaments years ago when they first kind of invented them. So I really don't have much help for you on that, except if you are basically a primarily cash game player.
Yeah.
You might just ask yourself, why are you playing tournaments? If you think you're playing them strictly for profit, then do the math on what you really expect to earn and compare mm-hmm. What you would expect to earn during those hours playing cash games. It might be right for you to play cash games. If you weigh the emotional cost benefit, like you said, it sounds to me like tournaments are very much not the right EV play for you. So then you have to ask, okay, why are you playing it? Maybe it's the glory. You know, you want the glory of it, which you should quantify that in a sense and say, with awareness, okay, this is why I'm doing it. It doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make emotional sense. But I want to win a goddamn bracelet, so I'm going to play a tournament. And if that's the truth, then tell yourself that. Then that's the truth.
Well, the other thing that I've been battling with, too, and I've talked to my friends about it, is that, okay, so let's give an example. So in the cash games, I'm playing either 75-150 or 150-300 mixed game, okay? So we have that hourly, which mm-hmm. is going to be much, much higher than an hourly for, like, say, like a $1,500 no-limit tournament
right.
or a $1,000 no-limit
right.
tournament, which are ones that I've tended to avoid. However, there is a big gold pot at the end of the rainbow in mm-hmm. those tournaments where I guess if you get lucky enough, you can win 600 or 700,000. So when we're talking strict hourly, the cash game hourly is definitely higher.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm trying to look
the
for
the life changing.
Yeah, the utilitarian equity yeah. of winning a bunch of
right.
mid six figure score.
Right.
You know, is that worth it to
right. the
to,
life
to
changing
go for
thing?
It?
Yeah. Right. I don't know. Is it? It's you know.
I mean, it would be nice to win that amount of money at the end.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I just, like I said,
but you
I
have
don't
to
know
add
what the answer
is. Is it worth? I mean, you know yeah. that, you know, you look at the probability of that actually happening mm. and you look at the, and you weigh up, you know, how much pain is going to happen all those times that it doesn't happen. And it still could come out that the right play is to fold.
Right, 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 right. And I don't know if it's necessarily pain when you get knocked out of those, but it, I mean, I guess it could get into situations where if you get really deep and you get a bad beat, it could ruin.
Yeah.
It might ruin your
right.
week and right might ruin your earnings potential and other types of games, right?
Right. Yeah, it can definitely, you know, throw you off track.
Yeah. What in terms of now you just published another book, right?
True.
And you're in the process of writing another
a third.
Book right now. So tell us mm-hmm. a little bit about the book that came out now and
okay.
the next book that you're
working
on. The
book that just
on.
Came out recently is called A Rubber Band Story and Other Poker Tales by Tommy Angelo. That's the full title. It's a collection of my my best articles from the years that I was a columnist and some of my blog posts. And it's so there's 55 stories in there. They're about one or two or three pages each. And then there are about 20 additional bits of writing that are about my writing process, or they might be intros to the section. Like, for example, there's one section called Alex Stories. My best buddy Alex Roberts, who's fairly well-known player in certain circles. We've been running around for years, and a lot of the articles I wrote were about our doings, our goings-on. And so, like, there's a little intro there to talk about when I first met him. We were playing at Artichoke Joe's. I just got off the plane from Ohio, literally just moved to California. He had only been there a year or so from Michigan, and we're both grinding, right? Limit hold'em. And we were, like, the only white guys in the room. And we didn't talk to each other for like 6 months because he was wearing a Michigan hat and I was wearing an Ohio State hat. So we wouldn't even talk to each other. You know, I was like hanging on to my identity. This is like one of the little intros in the book. So I talk about how I was like, you know, why would he even want to look that stupid? You know, just stuff like that. Anyway, there's all kinds of fun stuff in there. And I put it together with my editor, Anna Paradox, who is a big part of all of my writing. And so she's my partner on this project. So she had a big influence on it. And so far, it came out, you know, a month or so ago, and so far the reviews have been very, very positive. A lot of people, like in my family and you know, like friends of my wife who don't even play poker, have been reading it, And they say, you know, some of these stories, they can kind of skip through the poker hands, but still totally get the drift of the story and the characters and what's going on. And it represents a very fun period of my life, you know, the end of my grinding years, where I was just playing poker all the time, writing about poker, thinking about poker, you know, telling stories about poker. And there's a many variety of voices in here. I use different, like there's some straight up fiction stories. Some of them are stories about hands. Some of them are just musings and thoughts. And some of them, a lot of them do have lessons, you know, within the story. So it's called A Rubber Band Story, which is one of the stories, and Other Poker Tales. So that just came out recently. The other book I'm working on that I've been working on basically since I finished Elements of Poker a few years ago is called Painless Poker. And this book I've worked on and off on intensely for the last few years. It's kind of on the shelf right now while I finished up working on Poker Tales and also coming down here for the series. When I go back home in a couple weeks, my plan is to work on Painless Poker full blast, you know, for like a year or two or whatever until it gets done. And this book I'm very excited about. I'm calling it the prequel and sequel to Elements of Poker. So it's more about how I, like my backstory, a little bit more about that. And then when Elements of Poker came out, I did two more years of coaching, and almost all of my clients at that time were full-time professionals. So I've collected an enormous amount of more material. And I've already got it sorted out, and I'm going to, you know, lay it out in this book in a variety of ways. And that's what I'm working on.
Can you tell us one of the more interesting stories behind maybe like a high-stakes client or something that maybe, and obviously you don't mention names, but maybe some of us guys that don't play super high-stakes, you know, we have certain problems with tilt or emotional control. And, you know, maybe can you relate that to maybe some of the same types of problems that some of your high-stakes clients have had?
Well, you know, it's the problems are surprisingly the same.
Mm-hmm.
They really are. It really doesn't matter if somebody's playing super low limit or very high stakes. When we go temporarily insane, the same stuff happens. The big, big difference between the high stakes clients is the amount of money at stake is entire life bankrolls for normal people. You know, that's where it gets kind of weird. It's like it's a higher level of stuff that they have to process, especially like after the fact. You know, a guy will say to me, you know, I blew enough money last night that my parents could live on, you know, for 5 years in Florida and move into a better condo. You know, and when they tell me stuff like that, it's like, wow, you know, so they do have an additional layer of stuff floating around up there that us regular people don't. But on the other hand, when it comes right down to the moments of tilt and the different types of tilt that come up, it's all the same. It's about, you know, digging deep and finding out the root cause of what it is. Is it about feeling injustice because the cards weren't fair? Is it about feeling bad because you made a bad play? You know, it isn't. It is. Those things are independent. Those types of tilt issues are independent of the money.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever had have you ever seen a guy whose talent was so high that he was still able to play successfully at the highest stakes, but still also have like a severe tilt problem?
Well, it's hard for me to know just how much tilting any of my clients do, you know, relative to their opponents. But, you know, something you said there is kind of a tangent, but the way I look at it is, like when I was grinding, playing for a living, I had tilt, right? But the combination of my betting skill and my opponent's lack of betting skill was such that if I tilted, say, you know, 10% of the time, I could still make enough to live. If I had tilted zero, I would have made more, okay? But I had some amount of tilt that I could, say, get away with. Well, now as the entire amount of tilting that people do, I think, is gradually going down as the entire poker bubble boom matures, it's even more important for somebody to tilt less, higher limits or not, but the higher limits even more, because that's really where the profit comes from for a lot of the players is tilt reciprocality. So if you got, say, you know, six guys playing in the big game over at Aria, and they're all roughly equal in skill, you just kind of wait until the big pot comes up, and whoever loses that pot If he can hold his shit together, he's going to have a huge advantage in that game, because the next day it's going to be somebody else who loses that pot and who's going to tilt off a chunk. And I think at the higher levels, a lot of times the tilt reciprocality is the largest source of profit.
Yeah, and I think Barry Greenstein said that to me once too, that one of the money at the high stakes, or most of the money, was won through, or won and lost through steaming.
Yeah.
And even, and for example, I mean, the game that I've been playing, which is pretty high for me, which is 153 or 2-4, here, it's the same players, and everyone kind of has the same skill level. There isn't a huge
spot. Right.
Sometimes there's a huge spot, but it's rare. But, you know, the game is either good or bad depending on who's winning or losing.
Yep.
You know,
oh, exactly.
Guy A or B.
Oh, yeah.
If they're losing, then the game's not going to be good.
Right.
Because guy C or D are winning. But if guy C or D are losing,
here's a line,
then the game's great.
This story, it might be in my book, A Rubber Band Story, I can't remember. But this guy, Walt Z, who was one of the guys I basically learned their limit from way back when, he had a great line. Okay, let's say you got a player who is a solid player. And deep pockets, but once they lose a hand or two, especially early, you know, they can really go off and lose a ton. And then you got another guy over here who's a terrible player, and of course you want him to win every pot he possibly can, as long as it's not against you, right? So a big pot will come up, and let's say the terrible player is player A, and the good player that will tilt is player B, and the huge pot comes up, and player A sucks out on player B on the river, and Walt's line would be, well, that didn't hurt the game any.
Yeah.
It's just like what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I go to the same thing. I've been playing 5-10. That's my. I love playing the 5-10 no limit here with the uncapped buy-in. And a lot of young, really sharp players. I mean, a lot of really good poker talent. But I see that, you know, one of the reasons I'm doing really well in these games is I'm like more focused than I ever have been. And I'm really paying attention, like, every hand. This was like the worst training I got for no limit from limit. Was at limit, you really can get away with not really watching a whole lot. Mm-hmm. When you're grinding 20-40 limit and the games are loose in the old days, you don't need to watch a whole lot. You just know what's going on. You can see a guy turn a hand over at the river and tell he's good, he's bad, whatever, right? What position? And the tilt was kind of constant. I mean, the whole game was like tilty, right? These games, I got to pay super close attention. Every single time there's a significant pot, or any kind of like delay in the game even, I'm looking at whoever lost that pot, because they're good enough, even this young, they're good enough to not necessarily show the physical show their frustration physically, but I want to be able to feel it inside if they're about ready to snap, like on the next hand. Because a lot of times these little tilt spasms are very, very brief, and the whole game can flutter up at no limit for like two or three hands and then settle right back down. And during those two or three hands could be the critical time where I might see a flop I wouldn't otherwise see because the implied odds are very high at that exact moment. It's almost like, you know, a blackjack when the deck's hot. So at the 5-10 level, at least in these games, the players are tough. There's very few players that are just donators, and I really got to stay focused to catch these little tilt waves.
Now, what would you say to the people, that the young professionals, the kids that come in to the game nowadays, and more, they're more and more young kids, that don't really talk to anyone, they put on their hoodies, and I've asked this of people in the past, they put their hoodies on, their headphones on, they almost seem bitter, they might not be bitter, but they just don't talk to anyone, and they don't really interact with the people that are playing recreationally, and I see this all the time. Is it a part of poker player's job to be somewhat of an entertainer, to make it more comfortable for the people that are quote-unquote donating or that are recreational players to come into the game and have you know, a good time?
So we should play together sometime. It's obvious we haven't played. No, I don't. I think absolutely anything goes. I make no judgments whatsoever about anyone, about anything they do at a poker table, basically. I mean, if a guy sits there and gets completely hammered as a total asshole, that's fine with me. The guy wants to put on his sunglasses and hoodie and over his head, not say a word to anybody, that's fine. Maybe it's just from playing so much, but, you know, I think to a large degree, my own path towards non-judgmentalism has been dramatically accelerated by playing 2,000 hours of poker for so many years, because you just get to where, okay, it's fine. You know, I'm going to do what I do. You do what you do. It's like the most level playing field imaginable. So basically, I have no problem with any of that stuff. Now, back to what you said, you know, should somebody feel more obligated to like make players more invited to the game? the people who feel that way should do it. And the other people should say thank you for bringing them in. But if somebody wants to sit there and be quiet and not talk to anybody and even act like he's kind of an asshole, fine.
So there's no, you don't think that there's any responsibility on anyone to act in any sort of,
I really don't.
Any sort of way. What about berating players, berating bad players at the table? Saying, how can you make that call? Wow, you're an idiot. You know, you were drawing a one out, two out, something
I
like
never
that.
Complain about somebody who berates somebody else. Is that what you mean? No, because, you know, player A berates player B. So basically what player A is saying is, dear player B, I have an opinion about what you just did, and I'm going to tell you. Okay? Mm. Now, if player C thinks that player A should not be saying that, so player C says to player A, hey, player A, you shouldn't be saying that to him. It's the same thing. Player C is doing exactly what player A did, which is he's speaking up to give an unsolicited opinion about somebody else's behavior, which I don't think – I call it the chain of complaint. What I just described there, I call it the chain of complaint. You got one guy complaining, and you got another guy complaining about the guy complaining. I don't complain about any of it. I don't complain about the bad player. I don't complain about the guy berating the bad player. It's all just part of the flow of the game, really.
Yeah, but what if player A berates player B to the point where, number one, player B starts trying to play better because he doesn't want to be berated, mm-hmm. or he leaves the game? I've seen that before a guy gets – so
yeah,
attacked that he feels like, you know what, I'm just going to leave.
Well, I wrote a whole article about this very thing. And the analogy I use is, okay, I call it good advice, bad reason. It's good advice to not berate a player, okay? But to say you shouldn't berate a player because he might quit or because he might get better, I think is the wrong reason. Actually, this is straight out of the Eightfold Path. The analogy I use is you shouldn't hit yourself in the head with a hammer because it might break the hammer. Okay, it's good advice, but it's a dumb reason, right? I think the best reason to not berate a player is just because it's rude to treat someone that way, mm-hmm. anytime, okay? So that's how I feel about why you shouldn't berate a player. It shouldn't be just for profit. You know, it shouldn't be like, I really feel like telling this guy he's terrible, but I'm not going to do it because it costs me money. That's not like a moral reason to do mm-hmm. it. So that's how I feel about that. But then back to what you said, I still don't mind. I really don't. I don't get upset about anything that happens. There's literally nothing anyone can say or do at the poker table that's going to upset me. Even if this guy berates the biggest fish in the game and he quits in a fuss and everybody else is like, what'd you say that to him for? I just don't dip down into that mess. It's like, whatever, fine. He quit. Players quit all the time. I just don't care.
And what if, you know, well, there are also times where guys get really out of line where they start cursing or swearing and say something inappropriate where guys call the floor on them. Are you saying that you would never do that? You would never call the floor?
No.
No.
No. I mean, that's management. That's a management issue. Mm-hmm. You know, how they what they decide to throw players out for. Like, you know, lucky chances, you say fuck off, they'll just say, Joe, we like you, but come back tomorrow. And in Hollywood, you know, I've wondered what you would have to do to get kicked out of Commerce. But, I mean, it's a whole different world, right?
Right.
And that's management decision, the way I see it, all of it.
Right. In your last, well, you know, when you've been on the show before, you know, you've talked a lot about Tilt, and we're going to talk more about Tilt. Have you discovered any new theories or new feelings that you have about Tilt writing your last two books?
I wish you would have asked me that yesterday so I could have thought about it a little bit.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
New things about Tilt. Try to narrow that down a little bit. Can you?
Well, I mean, have you picked up any new techniques on how to control, how to work your emotional control in your game?
No, not new, but I have, let's say, modified my emphasis and my understanding about what's likely to work and what's less likely to work based on my last 2 years of coaching. And that is, it's already pretty clear to anybody who's, you know, watched The Eightfold Path or read the first book that I really think that putting awareness on your breathing in and out and sitting and your posture and your physical presence is highly beneficial. Well, now I've got more data to support this conclusion. Mm-hmm. Based on coaching I've done with guys where they come back to me and they say, wow, it really does seem like the more I do of that, the better I feel. You know, it's directly proportional. So, you know, more of that is really, really good.
So if you, and we did go over this in the other episode, but if you feel like you're tilting, I remember one of the big things that you said is that you can just concentrate on almost like a rhythmic breathing, right? Or just concentrating on
just in and out, literally. Just being aware of whether you are at that second breathing in or breathing out. And it sounds absurdly simple, but it is that simple. Mm-hmm. And it is like some... It can at sometimes seem like a magic trick where all of it, you know, you had these thoughts going on that were stressful, that were likely to cause tilt, or they are tilt, or whatever you want to call it, negative swelling up, heat, whatever you want to describe it. Now, it just so happens that that is the absolute most difficult moment to bring yourself to awareness and mindfulness. But if you can do it, and for some people, there's a trigger. It's like there's an emotional spike of pain, let's say, and then followed by an emotional need to like fix it, but there isn't anything necessarily they can do about it. Well, if at that exact moment they have already done enough training that they know how to just sit up and literally think in, out, nothing more than that, just aware of in and out, what that does is it immediately takes the train of thought that's streaming by, and it's just like locks on the brakes, diverts all power to something other than that chain of thought, even if it's only for a moment. Now, that doesn't mean that you won't go right back to right where you were, but for that split second you were at peace, relatively speaking, and at that moment, there might be more, it can create an opening for the tilt to just end, you know, for sanity to be restored. It's very common for us to be in situations where we're temporarily insane, and then we snap too. Our language is full of phrases like that. We snap out of it. So how do you snap out of it when you want to? On purpose. You have to stop the insanity and come back to something in the moment. Well, you could say, oh, you could use listening, or you're going to, you know, concentrate on this or that. There's nothing can come close to using the breathing as the go-to technique, because it's always there. 100% of the time, no matter where you are. If you're alive, you are breathing in or out. And you can always lock on to that awareness as a way to bring yourself back to the moment.
What do you think about actually getting up away from the table and working on that? Or do you think that that can be just done just as well?
No, that's
there?
Huge. That's definitely, you asked me, like, that's the most important thing is the whole breathing. There's many, many, many other things. Getting up from away from the table is, like, let's say, the second most important. Yeah, that's huge. Mm-hmm. And so what I suggest people do there is you definitely want to get up away from the table when you know you're tilted, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing can be better than that. But you want to hold off the tilt as best as possible by making sure you take breaks, you know, really good quality breaks. When I'm playing, I always get up at least every 90 minutes when I'm playing live. And if I were like on the grind, I would probably go maybe 2 hours, but never more than 2 hours. You know, I'll take a full round break and walk around, clear my head, you know, have a banana, whatever. And then when I go back to the game, especially playing No Limit, now it's kind of sad that I don't have all the information. I like to know who won and which pots. I always scan the stacks before I get up, and I look at them right when I get back. So I'm missing some key information, but it's also like a restart of the game for me because I've been gone. So let's say I had been playing a certain way. I can sort of have a game plan when I go back. I'm going to go in. I might decide to be a little peppier because I'd earned what Alex calls squeezer vig, or I might decide I'm going to just lock up and go into lockdown mode for a while. Of course, the cards have a role in that, but you can kind of reset everything and have a game plan. These are all things that can undo whatever sort of tilt had built up.
Well, what are the root causes of tilt, or what can you describe what exactly tilt is?
At the root cause, tilt is dissatisfaction with what's going on. And so now that's life tilt, right? If you're driving and a guy cuts you off, you're unhappy with what's going on at that second, so you get tilted. So tilt is dissatisfaction, unease. That's the root cause. So to get to the really root of it, you have to train yourself to be kind of satisfied with whatever's going on at any given time. Mm-hmm. So that's like the deep level. The next level up causes a tilt, you know, are basically losing. Any form of losing is painful. I've had many sessions where, you know, I know I played really well and everything was fine, but I lost and I just felt bad, right? Losing feels bad. the expectation of, you know, you've got the set and you've got the guy all in and you're expecting to win that pot. It's taken away from you. Just, you know, playing bad, knowing when you played bad, that's one of the, those are, I'd say, the main ones. You know, it's just the act of losing and then also knowing when we played bad.
Have you ever had a client come to you and say, you know, I'm going through my worst downswing of my career statistically, and I don't know if it's a variance thing or if I'm playing bad because of tilt?
I hear that a lot.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to sort out. It's really, really hard to sort out. You know, the recent software where you can see what equity you had on the all-in hands and this and that. You know, I have a lot of guys say to me, you know, well, according to the software, you know, I wasn't playing that bad. But upon further examination, it turns out that there's a lot of other hands in between, you know, where they're leaking or they're, you know, they're playing too many hands out of position or they're three betting too much or not enough or whatever, you know. But it's really, 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 that's one of the things about poker is it's really hard to know how much of your results is based on your abilities and your performance and how much isn't. Really hard to know. So I do hear that question a lot, but that's because it's a very common problem that we all deal with just as poker players.
Well, and also too, you know, the statistics, they don't, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the term Galfon bucks, which are like the
Galfon bucks. Oh, sure.
Equity against range as opposed to equity, you know, as opposed to all in equity.
Right.
So sometimes I think that some of those numbers can be a little bit, you know, be a little bit misleading.
See, but generally speaking, I think that people know there's a great deal of delusion in the human mind all the time. But then with poker, it's like we tell ourselves, oh, I didn't play that bad. I mean, I still say that to my wife now. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I lost this, but, you know, I play pretty good. And as soon as I say that, I somehow know I'm lying. I know that by even saying that, I'm covering up something.
I think you're right, because I think I might have said that a couple days ago to a friend of mine. I was like, well,
yeah,
I was stuck 15 grand, but I didn't play that bad.
Yeah, and see, so there it is. Yeah, so it's almost our job as poker players. My friend Doug said that poker players are in a unique situation to really dive into their own mind because we're forced to deal with this stuff. Where in regular life, you don't have all these emotional spikes, and you don't have money on the line when you're costing yourself because of your emotions. And so we are really, it's wonderful, I think, how we do this self-examination. But along the way, you got to say, you know, I think people know when they say, oh, but the software says I should have won this, so it must be fluctuation. It probably is to an extent, right? Mm. It's probably 50% or 80% of its fluctuation, but some amount of that is just bad play. And they know that the fluctuation beat them down. They were losing a little bit of leakage, this and that. And it's that extra 20% is what's hard to figure out. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, you did the series Eightfold, right?
Yeah, Eightfold.
Which
path.
Came out, what, almost a year
and a half ago? That was 2009, yeah.
Yeah.
Like summer of 2000. Actually, no, 2 years ago came out.
Yeah. 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And how important, well, we were just talking off mic about how we're about to get together with the Deuces Cracked guys. And
yeah, the home game.
Yeah, the DC home game, which will be this, tomorrow night of this week. And again, this episode's coming out.
Right.
Coming out next week, and I went to the drink fest and the bowling thing. Oh. It was a good time.
Did you go to the dodgeball thing?
No. Oh. Isn't that tomorrow too?
Oh, it is tomorrow.
Yeah.
You're right.
I'm
not going to that, obviously.
I'm gonna play in the PLO8 $1,500 tournament tomorrow, which I think is like the deadest tournament of all tournaments.
Oh, you mean most dead money?
Yeah.
Oh,
PLO8 is, you know, people are you just selling how to your, play the game. So
are you selling any? Can I buy $100 of your action?
You know what? I think I'm done selling action, okay. Unfortunately. Every time I sell off action, I don't cash, so I just decided to go off on my own.
You should have told me that first.
But so, you know, we both work for Deuces Cracked, getting together with the guys. It's nice to see them. Mm-hmm. How important do you think it is for people to continually train as well in poker?
Oh, well, if I were an online grinder right now, you know, I talked to Rob and Jay, we had breakfast the other day and stuff, and Joe. You know, I was asking about the businesses and that, and one thing Rob said that some guys are, they get some new members because it's like now's the time to work on their game. They can't play, so now they're going to go watch the videos that they wished they had been watching all along, but they were too busy playing to watch. So that I would be all over going into full study mode. If I were an online grinder and I was just kind of like waiting for poker to come back,
right?
I would be so all over Deuces Crack.
Do you have any opinion about the landscape of what's going to happen in the next five years?
Who the hell knows? I used to think of each poker situation I was in as like the end of the world. Like when I was playing with my buddies and, you know, in high school, and then the next poker pool I was in, the next one, grinding in Columbus, it seemed like it would last forever. And now that I've been through these cycles so many times, you know, like Lucky Chances, when they opened up, had 320 40s and a 40-80 every day and 81-60 2 days a week. And then, like, you know, a few years later, those games just aren't there. It seems like it's going to last forever when it's going on. And it just never does. And Black Friday proved that. And right now is the most volatile time ever. But the one thing to take away, I would say, to the professionals is don't think of this as like, okay, poker is going to come back and this is going to happen. It's just part of the overall landscape. It will always be changing. No matter what happens, it will always be changing dramatically. So the greatest skill a poker player can have if he wants to literally be able to play poker his whole life is the ability to adapt to whatever's going on and to be able to, you know, fish where the water's warm, as I call it. But to be able to do it without stressing. You don't want to freak out when this blows up. You're just like, okay, I expected that. Nothing lasts, and I'm going to go play over here.
I mean, because I was going to say, like, a pretty radical change, I would think, in someone's life would be, like, to move out of the country.
Move
to the Bahamas or to move to Thailand or something like that.
Yeah, there's guys doing that.
I actually haven't seen that many new guys come and play live poker. Even though poker is poker, I feel like, and this is my own personal opinion, I feel like the internet guys, they're so used to playing, you know, a lot of tables, you know, more than 5 tables, 10 tables, 15 tables, that when they come in and they play live, it's such a different occupation. It's not a different game, but it's a different occupation that they just don't want to do it.
Right, they don't want to.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, if they I have to play live poker, I'm going to do something else.
There's certainly going to be a lot of guys that make that decision, and that's going to be the right move for them. Definitely.
Right, I mean, and there's also, I mean, I personally wouldn't necessarily want to play 20 tables online instead of my apartment. I wouldn't want to do that if I had to do that all the time either.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, it is the same game, but there's definitely other considerations.
Yeah, well, that's one of the great things about poker now is there's so much variety that you can pick from a huge smorgasbord of options, you know, to find what fits.
Now, you said that you've been playing 5-10 here, which is the game that I talk about the most.
Yeah,
I love it. On my podcast, and, you know, I did a video series called Poker With Your Pants On about 5-10. What is your impression of what's gone on here? And I don't know if you can compare that to maybe when you played 5-10 a few years ago.
No, these games are definitely tougher than what the games I played in when I was playing for a living. There's no doubt about that. I like it a lot. My results have been very good. You know, I don't know how much of that's luck or whatever. I mean, going back to last year's World Series. But the thing I love about it is it's really brought out the absolute best of my game because they're tough. You know, just like when I played tennis all the time, I wanted to play against guys that could beat me, you know. And I don't want to play poker against guys that can beat me, but it's just been thrilling for me because their competence has forced me to really be on my toes. And when I'm playing at my very best, I'm really happy. I'm just basically happy, win or lose. And so that's why I'm really enjoying the poker. And they're challenging. There's some really good players.
And normally it's the younger ones.
Yeah, the young ones. Yeah. Well, it's like all young ones playing. I mean, I'm always the oldest at the game now at 52, usually. Mm-hmm. You know, by a significant amount.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Can I tell you something happened last night?
Sure.
This was so funny. So I'm sitting there, and I literally had not spoken since I sat down, and it had been like 2 hours, okay? And there's this hand comes up where I raise from the blind. There's like two, okay. There's an open and a caller, and I raise from the big blind.
Okay.
They both call.
Squeeze.
Right, squeeze play. And the flop comes, and I barrel. And the turn comes, and I'd already decided I was barreling. And it turns out that when I bet, I had not seen a guy stack size. And so, you know, my bet's like there was a straddle on this hand. So it was a pretty decent-sized pot. So my bet's like 400, and this guy goes all in for like 580. So it's an extra 180 to me, and it goes fold, and I don't instantly call. As soon as I didn't snap call, it was obviously the cat's out of the bag. And this is like one of the funny spots where somebody has to only call like one-fifth the size of the pot at the end. They can't call, right? And I actually, you know, and I had 6-7, so I did have a, and there was a chance he had a draw. So there was, I had to hit a pair to beat his hopeful draw. But I delayed longer than usual. Usually I would just muck there right away and not even think about it. But for some reason, I paused for a second, and the guy said, I like my chances a lot better now. And my normal game is I don't react to any of those comments at all whatsoever, right? And I said, I think I might have misread my hand. And then I'm like the whole table just exploded. The timing was perfect because I hadn't said anything on that. So that was pretty fun.
So you did end up mucking, though. That would be a hero call with no pair.
Seven high. But the point I was making there is, like, even though I'm not really engaging with them, you know, during the course of the game, because that's just the style I play, I really feel a great connection with these guys, young. You know, I feel like kind of like we're all in this together, and just, you know, we love poker so much, and here we are all in Vegas creating this temporary player pool and all playing 5-10, you know, and it's just the whole buzz of it. And everybody, I feel them feeling that. Everybody's just excited to be here and be playing. You know, felt good.
So, again, the book that just came out now is called...
A Rubber Band Story and Other Poker Tales. It's at Amazon.com, Amazon.de, Germany, Amazon.UK in England, print and ebook at all three.
Okay. And then the book that we should see in about a year and a half...
Yeah, a year and a half, 2 years, Painless Poker.
Painless Poker.
And the it's go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, and you also just did a video on the blue, or you,
oh,
you
I did it in one episode of the Blueprint series. Mine is episode 13 at Deuces Cracked.
Cool. So we can look for all of that stuff.
Yeah, oh, and I was on Joe and Chuck's podcast.
Oh, Hey Ball. Oh, cool.
And I was on Badoogie All Stars. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Tom Tecmo Super Bowl.
Oh, the new one. Yeah. The new one,
And Grinch the Grouch. Nixon the Grouch.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, cool. They're really, really funny. I was talking to Jay about it, and I told Jay that Tom was just hysterical, and Jay was like, really? I was like, yeah, he's very funny. Check it out.
All right, Tommy. Well, thank you again for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
And hopefully we'll get you on again at some point.
All right. Great. Thanks.
Until next week, we will see you guys all next time.